Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. Coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Women's History Extravaganza. I'm Carol Fitzgerald from BookReporter.com and the host of the Book Reporter Talks To video podcast series. I am so happy to be here tonight as we celebrate the launch of Lauren Willig's Band of Sisters with her own Band of Sisters. Joining us in discussion tonight are Marie Benedict, Kristen Harmel, and Vanessa Riley. And together, we're going to discuss determined women throughout history. And we're going to have a lively round of trivia where you all will have the chance to win prize packages of books and gifts. So let me now introduce our panelists. First, our guest of honor, Lauren Willig, who I am toasting on the launch of her new book, Band of Sisters, which will be in stores tomorrow. Lauren is the New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of more than 20 works of historical fiction and Rita Award-winning Pink Carnation series. She also has three novels co-written with authors Beatrice Williams and Karen White. Next, let me introduce Marie Benedict, a former commercial litigator in New York City who is the New York Times bestselling and USA Today bestselling author of The Mystery of Mrs. Christie, The Only Woman in the Room, The Other Einstein, Carnegie's Maid, and Lady Clementine. Notice I got that right. Which have all been translated into multiple languages. Next, we have Vanessa Riley, who holds a doctorate in mechanical engineering and a master's in industrial engineering and engineering management from Stanford University. She also earned BS and MS mechanical engineering from Penn State University, and her new novel, her first historical fiction, Island Queen, releases this summer. And last but certainly not least, we have Kristen Harmel, is a New York Times bestselling and USA Today bestselling and number one international bestselling author of The Book of Lost Names, The Winemaker's Wife, and a dozen other novels that have been translated into 29 languages. She is also the co-founder and co-host of the popular web series Friends and Fiction. So welcome, ladies. So nice to have you all here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So here's our plan for tonight. I'm going to start by interviewing our authors, and we're going to do that until about 8:35, 8:40, something like that. Then we're going to play a women's history trivia game where there will be prizes. And let's put this, I'm going to give you details on that closer to the time that we do that portion of the show. But believe me, there are great prizes. And our co-hosts are going to be sharing, doing the like Vanna White sharing of what these questions are. So this is going to be fun. Now, if you have questions that you would like to ask our author guests, see down below where it says ask a question. That is where you type them in. And we're going to have a quick Q&A session after our trivia game. So there is lots of excitement tonight. So Lauren, like toasting to you on the eve of Band of Sisters, we're going to go to you with my first question.
Okay, so I'm ready. I've got my bubbly.
Ready? Are you ready? Ready? Look, this is ginger beer. Let's get real. I can't lie. Okay. The women of Smith College in your book were mostly privileged women, but in rural France during World War I, privilege didn't really matter, or those trappings of success. I feel like historical fiction brings readers deep into a grounded place. What did you like about these characters shedding the airs that they walked around with? You're like, I know so-and-so, I've been with so-and-so, to get them to the place where you wrote this book.
Well, I think it really was a great leveler for these Smith women, but it took them a while for them to realize that, because these are these privileged upper middle class American women going off to do good for people. And I don't think they realize at the beginning just how very privileged they are. And there were a couple of incidents in their real letters home that then, of course, I shamelessly stole for the book that really highlighted this for me, that they found it very funny when one of them was propositioned in Paris right after they arrived. And when she turned around and spoke in her American schoolgirl French, the man immediately went bright red and fell over himself, apologizing because he hadn't realized she was American and he would never have propositioned her if he had known. So they thought this was hilarious. So they wrote about this in their letters home. But it became less hilarious several months later when two of them were out in a snowstorm late at night and their truck broke down. Their trucks were always breaking down. But this time it broke down by an abandoned inn and they wandered in to see if they could get someone to help. And there were a bunch of very disreputable guys hanging around there. And one of the pair was all, you know, all for staying. There was soup. She was hungry. It was warm and there was cold outside. But the other, whose French was much better, heard the man say something to the woman about there are rooms upstairs, aren't there? And they started trying to pull the coats off the women and they ran for it like crazy. And they realized that they were about to have been assaulted. And this was the first time because their privilege, even in the Somme, even in the mud, even though shells know no distinction between smithies and normal French women, at that moment, they realized that the privilege that protected them everywhere else had not extended to them there. And that was a big eye opener. And so I didn't have to bring them to a place. This book, the crazy thing about it was they did everything for me. I was just taking everything from their real life letters and then putting my fake names on them. So they really did the work for me and I just followed along.
Awesome. Well, I did like putting the truck together. Like, you're not just going to get the truck. Let's build the truck together. And it was with zero skills for being able to do that.
Well, this was their wonderful and crazy founder, the founder of the unit, Harriet Boyd Hawes, who was a pioneering archaeologist and very charismatic, but also eccentric, whose theory was if you were a smithy with the education you'd received, you should be able to do anything. And it didn't matter if you'd never met a chicken before, suddenly you could become a chicken expert. And if your truck was in parts and trunks on the docks, you could put it together. You were a bright girl, get a wrench and go to it. And some people found this attitude very invigorating and other people found it deeply obnoxious. But for the most part, the impressive thing was when she said, you're a smith, they figured it out. They generally did.
They generally did. And they went for it. Like, this is what we're going to do. So Marie, with the exception of the mystery of Mrs. Christie, you typically have written about the woman beside the man, women who were very influential, but not known for their accomplishments. What are you usually looking for in your subjects? They're not putting the truck together. So what are you looking for?
No, although I will say Lauren's women did a good job with the trucks and the chickens and a whole host of other things. And when you guys get to dive deep into the stories of these women, your head will literally spin. I mean, I just remember my breath was taken away by what these women didn't know what they didn't know. You know, they were going into these situations just blind and really rose up. It was really inspiring. And I can't wait for other people to read it, Lauren. It's just so good. For my own work, I sometimes do write about women who aren't just behind the man. You know, there's Hedy Lamarr and the only woman in the room too, but all the women I write about, I'm looking for something really specific. You know, I'm looking for women who have left a legacy, even though we may have absolutely no idea what that legacy is. Yeah. You know, in the case of Hedy Lamarr, it was Wi-Fi and nobody knew that. And, you know, I'm also looking for women who are really struggling with issues that we would consider very modern day issues as well. So, you know, we think about historic women as being very different from us, but in fact, they often grapple with issues of, you know, balance between work and family, issues of being of assault, harassment, marginalization that historic women dealt with and we can really learn from. So that's kind of the rubric I'm looking for. I mean, unfortunately, of course, history gives me no shortage of those women. But with Mrs. Christie, it was a little bit different because, of course, Agatha Christie has a huge legacy. And that was almost a barrier to entry, actually. Yeah. I almost didn't write the book about her because she's so well known. I felt like perhaps somebody else was more deserving of having their unknown story told. Yeah. But the more I looked at it, the more I realized that this facet of her life really wasn't known.
Yeah.
This facet of her persona and personality was completely unknown. And it really factored into how she rose up and claimed her legacy. And those issues that she grappled with in order to do so really, I felt like modern day women could really, really glean something from. So that's kind of how I find them and pick them. But they are literally everywhere, as I'm sure all these women, my band of sisters here today, know. They're
band of sisters. So Vanessa, this is your first book of historical fiction. So welcome to the club, first of all. Island Queen is definitely going to have people taking note of you. I mean, I was reading this, and what drew you to make this pivot and write about Dorothy Kerwin Thomas's extraordinary life? What drew you to do this?
A couple of things. I think, like Marie said, we're always looking for stories of these women who have been marginalized or hidden in history. And particularly for me, I want to find my foremothers. I want to find the people who were doing things that the stories just haven't been told or they've been suppressed. I literally found a cartoon, a political cartoon set circa 1788-ish kind of thing. And it's Prince William Henry, and he's in bed with a beautiful Black woman. And typically when cartoons are drawn with Black women, they're made garish. They have bulbous lips because they're part of the joke. Mm-hmm. But when you look at this picture, this is tattletale. Someone is trying to tattle on the prince that he has the audacity to be in a relationship with this Black woman. And so for 6 years, I hunted and found snippets of Dorothy Kerwin here and snippets over here. And her life is incredible. The wars that she survived, the children she bore, the men in her life, that's a whole other story. But her ability to look beyond her immediate circumstances to how do I impact the women around me? And her legacy is literally defeating an unfair tax that was all the women of color in the colony of Demerara. If it not for her going to England and fighting this tax, the generational wealth that these women, these free women were building would be wiped out within two generations.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
That's amazing.
And you come across that and it's just like, I need to write this story. That's I need to do this
incredible.
Now.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just some things just fall in your lap and then some things are a passion. And this is kind of a combination of the two.
Yeah.
And it takes you on a journey. And literally with my romances, I feel I've always been writing Dorothy. I just didn't know her name.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's awesome. That.
I love that.
So, Kristen, in the Book of Lost Names, a woman comes to term with the idea that her act to save someone will have ramifications later, as she will need to connect the children who she's trying to help and protect at this point with their she's protecting from the Nazis, but someday their families may not be able to find them.
Yeah.
What is right? What is wrong? And sometimes these decisions in historical fiction and in history are not concrete. What feels heroic at the time, but then their costs. So talk to us about that, because I see that a lot in your work of there's a price to pay and you've got to pay it later.
Well, and that's such a good point. Thank you for putting it that way. And I do also want to say, Lauren, I loved your book so much. And I'm so excited that everyone here tonight is going to get to read it because it was such a wonderful book. And I'm just so happy to be here celebrating with you. And Vanessa, I cannot wait to read yours. And Marie, I read your next one. I'm super excited about it. So I feel very honored to be in this company tonight. In historical fiction, as in history, there are no easy answers. And I think that the meat of a good story lies in those gray areas. You're not totally right. You're not totally wrong. But what are you doing in the middle? And that's one of the reasons I think I'm really drawn to World War II also, because you know going in the door, there's a winner and there's a loser. There's the good guys and the bad guys, right? But the gray area in between is so interesting to play with. But I also think, and you know, you mentioned that it's kind of something I keep coming back to, that type of question. I also think it's that idea of finding out who we are and what decisions we make in the moments of darkness and the moments of difficulty that define us. And I think that's something that kind of is a thread that runs through the books of all four of us, that you don't really realize who you are until your back's up against the wall and you have that difficult decision to make. And so, you know, that's something I keep returning to. And I think that's something that draws people again and again to historical fiction and makes it feel modern, even though we're writing about the past.
Yeah, yeah. And that's actually going to lead me to, Lauren, the question, Band of Sisters, your protagonist, Kate, signs on to this project a lot less willingly. Like, she is not really sure she wants to go be with these women. She was not one of the wealthy Smith girls. She was kind of ostracized because she was not, you know, of the same caliber or whatever. And she's felt like an outsider for years. And I feel like there's something to be said there about the way women must come together when times get tough. And everybody's just got to look beyond, like, you know, who we saw that, you know, what was going on.
Yeah.
So through the years, your character has been through so many challenges. What draws you to be writing these determined kinds of women?
Oh, goodness. I think it's partially, well, yeah, there could be a certain amount of contrariness in it, because I think we spend most of our lives being told that historical women didn't do things, that we're told that they were angels of the hearth, and that, you know, in the olden days, women sat peacefully at home with their kerchiefs over their heads. But, you know, when you go looking, you find people like these Smithies 10 miles behind the front lines who are not doing what you would expect women to do. And they are very determined. They have to be determined to get their passes and get out there when no one thinks they're going to succeed. In fact, the Red Cross refused to sponsor them initially because the Red Cross thought they were going to crash and burn. And, you know, it's funny, later on, the Red Cross takes them on under their rubric. And by that point, only a few months later, they joke that this is great for their own PR because everyone knows about and loves the Smith unit. And so, you know, this will be now great for the Red Cross, who initially refused to sponsor them. But so, and I think, you know, if you look at all of my books, you find this linking thread of women who are doing things that women aren't supposed to have done, but did. Women spied during the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah.
You know, women did all sorts of other things. So it just, I think that unearthing these stories and putting them back into the narrative is so important, and making it clear that there were women who bucked those dominant traditions in every generation.
Yep.
You know, I was actually thinking back today to reading the first book of yours that I read, which was The Ashford Affair, which was, I was trying to figure out what year, and it was always these very strong women, and she's sitting apart, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm just going to go plow ahead. And this time, I really love the fact that she didn't want to, because she didn't think she was going to be accepted as part of the group. But really, it became the level playing field changed so tremendously. It was, we all were out in the same kind of situation. Nobody was dressed haughtier. Nobody was doing anything different. It was all the same. All the same.
I am fascinated by the way people find out who they truly are in the crucible of these situations, that you think that we all have these fixed ideas of ourselves and what we're capable of and what our friends are like too, honestly. And this is a friendship book as much as anything else. And then you get into one of these situations where you're challenged and you find yourself having to try new things, and you discover that you have whole sets of strengths you never imagined you had.
Yeah. And we just have to go pull them together, and we all have to be together in order to get something to work, including making the truck. Now, Vanessa, Dorothy, who is also called Doll, seemed to never acknowledge that anything wasn't possible. Everything was possible. You can actually do this. Now, I'm going to ask you a very different question, because your background is in mechanical engineering. My son is a mechanical engineer. My husband is an engineer. And which for years was traditionally not a women's field. I mean, let's get real. It was always the guys, it was going to be the engineers. But it also doesn't point you towards a career in writing. And you've got all these fabulous degrees. What from your engineering career have you brought to writing? Because there are things that you learn doing there. What happened?
The ability to ask how and why. How do certain things work? I mean, you know, when we're looking at these histories, just imagining walking out of the door. Well, what does the doorway look like? How was it made? How is it constructed? So that passion, from my early on, I was the dual nerd, right? So I love Western Civ. That was like my favorite types of classes. And I loved math. And my mama said, get a job that will pay bills. So we did But the passion never leaves you. And for me, the ability to always ask the question why and how is directly from my engineering experiences. And the fact that I'm hearing that Band of Sisters has women tinkering with trucks.
Oh my gosh. I don't understand what they're doing. you can definitely QC those pages, and you'll know. Wait a second. Wait, this is what you're supposed to do. Yeah, it's. Yeah, you know, I'm really curious though, because yes, you're right. Because there's a way to do things that work well when you can't build something and get to point X before you're here. And I'm thinking that as you're writing, it's like you know how to do the building blocks of building the book at the same time.
Absolutely. And it's just, you know, because I theme my books as just like these lovely women do, and always asking myself, am I delivering the why? Am I telling you how they made it? Am I giving you enough information? These are currents from my degrees, from my unfortunate dissertations that I bring forward.
Okay, what's worse, page proofs or dissertation? Which one's harder? Which one's less fun?
Well, that would be page proofs. When you have a last minute font translation, that's when. Just saying.
That's where the difference lies. Okay, this is what we're learning. Marie, so you were thinking you might not do Agatha Christie. You were really like, you know, going back and forth. What made you decide she gets her own story? Okay, fine. I'm going back and forth on this. Let me see why.
Right. I think, you know, and I'm sure all the other authors here have this experience. It's like when you take that dive, right? And you're deep into the woman's world, and you're in the thicket of the research material, whatever you can get, you know, and it's very so much from women to women. It's not, Lauren here had these wonderful letters she worked with. I mean, letters are like, you know, the treasure trove. They're the ultimate.
Yes.
But whatever that is, when you're in there and you're in that thicket and you sense the story that's there. And I think here that's really like the litmus test for me, you know, when I'm in there. And I think in this particular case, I dove in thinking I knew what to expect, that I knew who Agatha Christie was, you know, the silver-haired matron sipping the tea and crafting the poisonous, you know, murders. But the reality of who she was as a young woman, you know, sort of her years as a young mother, young wife, the crosshairs she found herself in the days leading up to her disappearance. Yeah. I thought I knew what that was going to look like, but the Agatha Christie that I thought I knew, the disappearance that I thought I understood, was not at all what it turned out to be. And what I uncovered was like so much more incredible and magnificent than I could have. I mean, I'm sure you guys all have this experience that the facts that you uncover, the historical facts, are so much more amazing than fiction. Like, you can't believe that they actually occurred. Like, the material is just waiting there. So, and I think, you know, the more I dug into it, the more fascinating, the more layers that were available to the story. And then, of course, she published The Murder of Roger Ackroyd right before she disappeared, which is, you know, the quintessential unreliable narrator novel. And I just could not get that theme out of my head. I couldn't get the theme of this notion that a woman who was this expert in the art of crafting this unbelievable story, so masterful, her talent in that book in particular, she couldn't have been a victim in her own vanishing. And sort of that idea of who she was, that kind of evolves from being in the thicket of the research, and a sense of understanding where she's going, you know, that legacy that she's leaving, kind of all got into the mixing pot with the unreliable narrator. And I just couldn't, I knew it was a story I had to tell, because it was a story really about all of us, about what we do when our back's against the wall, when we're caught in the crosshairs, we don't know what the right next step is going to be. And how are we going to rise up if we do rise up and claim our, not just our legacy, but also that authentic path. And I do think that Christie did that. There definitely was a cost, a huge cost to her. She wasn't the same person on the other side as she was at the beginning. But her legacy was greater, for sure. So I think it was all those multi-layered, nuanced portrayal of her and those very modern issues that the story just wouldn't go away. It just took away. It just
took hold when that let go. So, well, Kristen, champagne is a great topic for tonight as we celebrate Lauren and women of history. And in The Winemaker's Wife, your present day character, Liv, is being guided by her 99-year-old grandmother, who I just love, like hits the plane, is on her third martini as they're crossing the ocean, who has a lot of spunk and she's not afraid to speak her mind. And I don't think that just came with age. I think that was her all along the way.
Yeah.
You know, we talk a lot about right now, people that are in their 90s grew up during the Depression and now they're in the pandemic. So at both sides of their lives have been very, very difficult times. Do you think that tough times help shape that era of women? Like what they were through at the beginning has shaped them all the way through? Because right now you say, sit home to my mother and my mother-in-law who are in their 90s. And they're like, okay, that's what you do. That's the way life goes.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Oh, I'm sorry. Are you done? I'm sorry. I'm realizing I maybe cut off your question.
Go.
I think that's so true. And I hadn't really thought of it that way before. In The Winemaker's Wife, I think of the delightful 99-year-old spry and sassy Grandma Edith, mostly just being shaped by the lifetime pickling of her liver. I mean, that seems like the... she's done that with great skill throughout her life. I do think we are shaped by the hard times and the challenges. And... yes, I do think there is something to be said for that idea, like you said, of people being born during the Depression and understanding those difficult times or living through World War II. It's interesting because I think World War II and, you know, historical fiction in general, but really World War II seems to have had kind of a moment over, you know, the last year or so. And I think part of that is because it's that idea of another tough time shaping us, which we're going through again. And I think that probably resonates through all of our historical fiction novels, certainly World War I, as is the case in yours, Lauren, also. It's those tough times that do make us who we are and make us into, you know, the 99-year-old lady on the airplane sipping a martini, as we all should be, right? I also have to say, Vanessa, I was so interested to hear you say that it was your background as a mechanical engineer that led you to be asking the how and the why, because I come to writing historical fiction as a journalist, which also taught me to ask the how and the why, but in a completely different way. So I just found that really fascinating that, you know, even if we didn't necessarily plan it, the lives we had before did lead us here. And, you know, when you kind of put that in motion with our characters too, and with this exploration of history, it's that life path that you're on, even if you don't know that you're on it, that shapes you into who you're meant to be. I don't know. I kind of like that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it makes it deeper and richer
because
of our lived experiences that we each bring to our books and to our heroines, protagonists. I mean, I think it just makes it so much richer.
Absolutely.
Oh, I agree.
Lauren, when you were finding the letters, when you were reading the letters about the Smithies and what was going on, did you see each of those characters like quite clearly, like as you were reading, and were you making notes and being able to draw who you thought they were and things like that?
Yes, I have sticky notes all over the letters because to be fair, some of the letters I largely mined for material. There were some people whose voices writing home were not as strong, but they provided very good details about their life in the psalm and all that. And then there were other people who I immediately had an impression of one way or the other. There was one very warm-hearted woman who wrote about spending her time begging books for the children from publishers in Paris, because these were children who hadn't had a book in 3 years. And so, you know, that resonated deeply with me. I had this immediate image of her, which turned into the unit's librarian in my book. And then there was another woman whose letters I hate read with great glee because she wrote the nastiest things home. She was a font of bigotry and snobbery. There was a lot of anti-Catholic commentary. She was nasty about, she said she hated the Germans even more than she hated the Turks, and she really hated the Turks, so that should tell everyone how she felt. And there were few groups for whom she didn't have something incredibly nasty to say. She hated their director, who she called a horrible old pacifist, and you know, also informed the people at home that she had bought a pistol so she could try to pot a German, because she had heard that, you know, they would give you the croix de guerre if you did that. Anyway, I mean, her letters were marvelous because she was so unrelentingly nasty. And so I turned her into a character in the book. And, you know, the thing is, though, that I think readers will think she's over the top, but the truth is I actually toned it down from the letters. It's amazing It's amazing how you can get a sense of personality from these bits of paper written over 100 years ago, especially when you see the letters themselves and you see that someone was writing in the cold, in the dark, and their pencil was blunt. And you get a real sense of both their innermost feelings and the circumstances in which they were living from it. And it feels like such a gift to be let into someone's life like that. And as Marie was saying, it's very rare that you get that kind of material and you have that sort of inside information, so to speak. My last book was a Caribbean book about an enslaved woman. And I was spending all my time triangulating around absences and trying to figure out what absences meant. Whereas in this one, I had, 15 people's accounts of the same situation. It wasn't an absence. It was trying to figure out who was being most accurate and how to align their impressions.
And whose point of view you wanted to tell it from? Because you don't want to tell it. It's like, okay, where's the narrative actually going to work on telling this story? You know, you think about it, you look at letters, you look at things that you found. Think about where our history is right now. It's all in email. It's all in, different. Like, who is going to be able to mine our stories of the pandemic? And I was really thinking of you all. I know you all have children, young children, or, teenagers at this point. We're living in really challenging times right now that someone's going to want to write about someday. And these are times where women are bearing most of the burden. And that's what we've been talking about a lot is women are bearing the burden. Women have lost jobs, all these things that are happening. But when we go to write about this someday, when they're going and looking for your letters, where will they be? It will be in chat rooms. It will be, there's just no recorded history. And I feel like you should all be keeping notes. You should be keeping really good notes. And they should be like held someplace because there's a time in history we're just not seeing the same things about.
Well, and also I think the other problem is what will survive, what will be remembered, what will be written into the official histories. One of the things that really struck me with the Smith College Relief Unit is that I had never heard of them. Most Smithies have never heard of them. But when you go looking, they were media sensations in their time. There were tons of articles about them. And that's all just gone by the wayside. It got lost along the way. They were written out. And I keep thinking, because I'm home with my 3-year-old and my 7-year-old. My 7-year-old is watching. Hi, Maddie. Anyway, I'm home with my 3-year-old and my 7-year-old locked up in here through the pandemic. And I have been reading voraciously every article about the parents are not okay. Women are bearing the brunt. Women are losing jobs. Women are stepping back from the workforce. And it feels like there's a new article every day. And none of them say anything new, but they make you feel better because you know you're not alone on the island. But I keep thinking about the lost archive of all of those articles on the Smithies. And I keep thinking, someday when someone writes the official history of the pandemic, none of this. It doesn't matter that the New York Times has a new opinion piece about this every other day. No one is going to write about how women's careers were destroyed by this, or the women who gave up their work to stay home with their kids, or the way people's lives were turned upside down. It's the story is going to be about the virus itself. It's going to be about the doctors on the front lines. It's certainly not going to be about us being like, sure, you can watch another 3 hours of Blaze in the Monster Machine.
Look, my sons are 26 and 31, and this is my line. You know how I used to say, oh, I wish they were still little? I don't say that. I don't say, oh, I wish they were still young. No, I'm perfectly happy that they're 26 and 31. It's just fine. And it's, and also I last year I said, okay, if any of you as authors brought the pandemic into your editor and said, let me just go, it's going to happen. The kids are going to be home for a year. Like, we're going to all be at our houses. If you wrote this whole thing down, they'd go, take half of it. Take it out. There's no way this could happen. No way this would all end up happening. But I think it's going to be very interesting to see how history treats looking at particularly women during this time and what ended up happening. And I think that the more that is shared about this as a shared history for later on, because look, people can rewrite history later on. Oh, the Depression wasn't so bad. Oh, this wasn't that tough. Oh, we got through it. But getting through it and living life are two totally different things. And I think that that's what people are doing right now. A lot of people are just clawing their way through these day after day with happy for iPads, and children's programming on them.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of the time the problem isn't even so much a rewrite as is a focusing of the lens, because every writing of history is an act of choice, just the way when we what we choose to include in our books is an act of choice. And so people aren't deliberately misleading or trying to change the narrative. They're simply focusing on what they think is important. But that shapes the way future generations see it. And quite often women are not seen as that important when writing these things.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really hope that, you know, that what we're all doing in terms of, you know, like you were saying, Lauren, making sure that that lens is inclusive of women and people of color and marginalized people, you know, we're looking back and rewriting them back into history.
Yes.
I hope that people can take that lesson and apply it to now. I mean, because you're raising a great point about what's how the pandemic is going to be viewed from the future. Right. And my God, we are working so hard to make sure that people see women in like World War II in a variety of places. Yeah. I hope that the future sees us where we are, because certainly what's happening in the pandemic is going to affect the next generations of not just kids, future children, but women. And, you know, I mean, if you read those articles in the New York Times, you can see that, how this might reverberate into the future. Yeah. So hopefully we won't be lost. Hopefully.
No, but just keep writing. Keep writing in public places about your real stories and what was going on. But you think about all the things you've been able to uncover. Every single one of you has talked about being able to uncover a story. And I just think about going forward, where are those stories? And also you're interpreting what you've read that somebody's written, but they wrote it through their lens. What one of the Smithies wrote is because of what she felt and was because of her background or whatever. Somebody else could see it completely differently. And I think that's what I love about reading your historical fiction is you're seeing a bigger like viewpoint of what's going on instead of just this is the way it was.
Yeah, that's
exactly right.
So, well, I think it's time for us to play some trivia. So I can explain. Here's what we're going to do. You are going to be asked some trivia questions, and we're going to give everybody a chance to win prize packages of books and gifts from our authors. We're going to have 10 questions that we're going to go through, and each correct answer gets one of the gift boxes. The first person to type into the chat box, which is on the side, will win, and they will be called out in the iChat and identified as the winner. You'll be contacted by a representative from the publisher. Now I feel like I'm on like the today of the a game show. You will be contacted by a representative of the publisher for your mailing address. You can only win once. There's another qualifier. So if you win, please give other participants a chance to win. And stick around for the end of the Q&A. What we're going to do is we're going to do trivia. Then we're going to go to some Q&A. If you have a question, please put in the ask a question down below. I see 11 people have done that. So I'm going to be jumping on and looking at questions that we will be asking of our panelists. And but you have to stick around for the end of the Q&A because the last question is going to be from Lauren, who we're honoring this evening. And she's going to ask the last question. So she's also going to get to ask the first. So Lauren, why don't you start us off with our first trivia question?
Okay, here we go. And this one's very dear to me because this is someone I have toyed in the past with the idea of writing a book about, but this does not tell anyone anything because I have toyed with many people and many book ideas. So the question is, who was the first woman to run for president of the United States?
Ding, 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 ding. We're watching over on the chat to see who's answering.
Don't all answer at once.
I mean, there's a lot of crickets.
That's like a lot of Googling.
No, yeah. Anyone? There are great prize packages, everyone.
Nope. Wait, I see it. I see it. It was up there. Okay, moving on to question two. Over to you, Marie.
Moving on to question two. Go ahead. Marie, you're up.
Okay. Who was the first woman appointed justice to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Dun, 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 dun,
dun, dun. I don't think we've moved on to the next question here. People are still, shall I read it again, Carol?
Yes, please do read it again. We're on the second question, everyone. Here we go.
Oh, I see
the answer is there. Okay.
We see an answer. We see an answer. Anne Marie, I think we've got you. I think we've got you. I think they're lagging. They're lagging in their answers. Oh, wow. Now they're all flying in.
My sister won.
Okay, we get it. We got it. You all got it. Sandra Day O'Connor. We got it. The spelling count. Yes, it does. No, I don't know.
No.
I'm not the arbiter of that. This is not like
the intent, not spelling.
The grammar.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Question number three, Vanessa.
Who is the first person to win two Nobel Prizes for science? No, not Sandra Day O'Connor. No.
That would be really funny. She was really busy in between being a Supreme Court justice.
She had a lot of spare time.
Just got it.
I think we've got it.
Yep.
But the spelling issue comes up again.
The spelling issue? I don't know. I think we're going to let spelling go. I think that's the vote.
Let that go.
Oh, look at this. I love, but I do love seeing what people are suggesting. I love this.
Mm-hmm. Mm, me too.
I don't think I would have gotten one right so far. Just to make anybody feel better in the audience who doesn't know the answer, I would have one. Okay.
And for the nerds in the house, 1903 and 1911.
Oh, those were nice. Wow. Oh, good. Prizes. Okay, good.
And these are very good. Little trivia, extra trivia. That's extra points. Extra points over there.
Yeah, bonus.
Kristen,
points.
You've got question number four.
Yeah, question number four. What female tennis player was a serious advocate for equal pay at Wimbledon and successfully went on to become the first women's champion to, in fact, get equal prize money?
Ooh, what?
Good guesses, but...
Nice try.
Yep, yep. Excellent. Nice. That's exactly what I would have guessed, everybody, but...
I would have guessed it.
Yeah, I thought that was it.
I think you won before, though. So let's see. I think she's won before. So let's keep going.
Okay.
Did she? Oh, no. William Morrow says Piper wins. I don't think she won before.
Okay.
Okay, right. Great. Okay, congratulations. That's fantastic. Great. Yep. Venus Williams. Yep.
My turn to ask a question. What woman was the first African-American woman to win the Nobel Prize for Literature? I feel like the panelists should be like, you know, secretly writing on a piece of paper and then hold up who they guess.
I think that would be a big note card.
Again, yeah, yep. We should do.
Oh, we have a winner.
Yep, we have a winner.
Yay.
I think we have a winner. Yes, we do. Good. Should I then say what the answer? Well, I'll go back and do the answers at the end. How's that? Yep. Okay. Okay, I think that we go to Marie next.
Yes. This, too, is a question that is near and dear to my heart. What Guinness World Record does Agatha Christie hold? Shall I read it again? Or there's just a lag, right?
What's
a lag?
There's a lag.
I like that.
I like the suggestion of golf.
I do too. Golf did figure prominently in her life, although
you may need a judge to interpret.
Yeah, but I think that's a really good point. That's a very good point. Because that could be interpreted a bunch of different ways.
Uh-huh. Yes. William Morrow has declared a winner.
Yes. They declared a winner? Okay, we've got a winner. Okay, here we go.
Obviously, although I like that suggestion.
Yes.
Okay, I believe that Vanessa is up next.
Yes. And this one is near and dear to my heart for two reasons. Who was NASA's first Black female engineer?
Oh, we're still on the Christie-verse.
Yep. We're still on the Christie-verse. I think, yes.
All right.
That's a rabbit hole you might never come out of, actually.
I like the Hidden Figures lady.
Oh, I'm starting?
Oh, wait. I think it's there, but misspelled.
Yep. Oh, no. I think I
know. Somebody's got it.
Yep.
Somebody got it.
That's it.
Yes.
Cool.
So.
Okay, right. Kristen, I think you're up for question number eight.
Question number eight. What is the name of the allegorical cultural icon of World War II who represented women who worked in factories and shipyards?
I feel like we should all make the pose now.
I know exactly.
Is that, like, is that a giveaway? Too,
yeah.
Well, it is kind of a giveaway. Becky got it.
Yep. Awesome. Good job.
Oh, yeah.
No, there's a definitely a delay, and then everything comes in.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay. And I'm going to do question number 9. Remember, we're holding question number 10 for after the Q&A. So question number 9, in what year was the first woman of color elected to the House of Representatives? Ideas?
Yeah, that one was a hard one.
That was a hard one.
Because hard one.
And then there's the difference of elected and actually served. Like,
right.
We can really break it down.
Yeah.
Once again, I'm happy I don't have to decide.
I feel like most of them are kind of in the ballpark.
I know, they're sort of playing
Yeah.
Very impressive.
Like, I know, yeah.
No, I wouldn't be close.
Oh, I think I see it. Yep.
Okay, Katie, you got it.
Okay, there we go. Yay. Okay, everyone stick around because we're going to go to the Q&A now, and then we're going to go back to the last question, which Lauren is going to ask before she does closing remarks. So the first question, Lauren, is for you. How many letters did you have to use for your research?
Well, it's less have to, and how many was I privileged to get to read? Because it was such a treasure trove. This is like, you know, this, you can hear the little jackpot noises going when you find out there are letters there. Yeah. Because I found these tantalizing snippets that had been printed in the Smith Alumni Quarterly in 1970 and 18, where people had sent letters home, and then their parents had sent them into the Alumni Mag, which edited them for the good parts and put them in. And then, of course, people later, when I read the private letters, would write in their letters home, like, stop sending my letters to you. I'm not going to write you anymore if you do that. But anyway, so I'd have these tantalizing snippets that were clearly heavily edited. And so I was like, oh my gosh, there has to be more. And so I looked in the archives at Smith, and lo and behold, it had lists of the names of the various unit members and whether there were letters or journals or so on from them. And so I said, well, could I have all of the content from the, you know, I gave them a list of names, and they were like, do you realize how many pages that is? And I was like, do you mind doing it? And they're like, well, there'll be a fee. I'm like, I don't care. I'll pay whatever as long as you don't mind. And right. So they digitized these thousands of pages of material for me.
Oh.
And it was just, it was incredible. So, I mean, the only hard part was the handwriting. Like, some of them had brought typewriters with them, and I loved those people. Really? Even though the typewriters were wonky, you could really skim those. But the handwritten ones, oh my God, and sometimes they were handwriting them in really bad conditions. And it's like, your handwriting wasn't good to begin with, lady, and now it's really illegible. And you're squinting trying to figure out what on earth this word was, especially if you want to quote it later. And it's like, well, it's not. You know, and this is just really weird slang? Or am I misreading? Right. Somehow.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Was this right? What was she saying?
I just have to comment on the fact that some of them actually brought typewriters to help out in the
war zone. That's amazing.
That's unbelievable.
What did they brought everything with them. I mean, they brought literally a boatload of stuff. They brought portable houses with them in pieces. They pre-bought before they left the States these houses that they were going to use to help build places for the villagers whose homes had been destroyed. And so when they drove down from Paris to their headquarters, one of the things they had was their long truck, which was piled high with these pieces of portable houses. And I mean, they could barely drive, and the truck kept stalling out. So this was
That's so funny.
Wow. Oh, wow. Ambitious.
Next question actually is for all of you. Do any of you have an assistant that does your research for you, or are you doing everything yourselves?
Everything.
Anybody with an assistant?
I have a secret weapon. My secret weapon is a really good friend of mine who's a librarian in Georgia. And when I get really stuck, I cry on Vicky, and she finds me impossible sources that I never knew existed. Like, when I was writing my last book, The Third Country, my heroine was an English woman who came, well, one of my two heroines was an English woman coming to Barbados in 1854. And she found me letters from an English woman writing home from a visit to Barbados in 1854. And you know, the stuff, how could that possibly exist? But Vicky is magic and she finds these things. So if Vicky is listening,
I'm gonna need Vicky.
I know.
You have a hard time.
Vicky, yeah, that's exactly Vicky. You know, I think Vicky could be for hire. She just doesn't know it yet, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. I have to say, I don't know if everybody else feels this way, but I feel like I couldn't do the I couldn't have somebody else do the research because it's in the research that, you know, you think you know the story, but the story really reveals itself in the research and in the details. Mm-hmm. You would lose the whole nuance. Like maybe you could have somebody tell you what a particular clothing style was in a certain time period, but it would be very discreet things. Otherwise, you'd lose the voices and the gist of the story, and you lose all sorts of fun tidbits that would work their way into the pages.
I totally agree. Oh, sorry, Vanessa, go ahead.
Vanessa.
I was just saying this. I don't know about you ladies, but oftentimes when I'm looking for something, I find something totally different.
Yes.
Blows my mind.
Yes.
And it's like this thing that it's going to end up in maybe not this book, but it will end up in another book.
Oh, totally.
Sometimes it changes the whole course of a book. When I was writing one of my books, Vanessa in India, I read this book by William Dalrymple, White Moguls, and the entire location and action of the book shifted to a different part of India and a whole different narrative. Wow. It's like that. And you know, afterwards you think this book could never have been any way but the way it was. But there were those moments where you read something and you're like, this changes everything.
100%. Right. That's happened with almost every single one of my books. I think I'm looking for one thing and I find another, and that forms the core of the story. But you know, I do wish I had a researcher I could call after the first draft is done to say, like, can you go through and just tell me all the things I've gotten slightly wrong? The things that seem okay in my head, but like, I'm going to pore over every line and agonize about, like, well, did they actually have this color thread in that year? You know, like those little teeny details that take like days and days to research, and you're still not totally sure if you've gotten it
right.
And
you're never sure who's going to call you out on them, and you think you're right, but you're not 100% sure, you realize. Yes. And then you're pretty sure you've seen something somewhere, and you go hunting for it to try to validate yourself, and then you can't find
it. You can find it again.
My rabbit hole is euphemisms. Like, were they actually used?
Yes.
That's a tough one.
Yes.
The language in general is so tough.
The language, 100%. Yeah, not just the time, but the place too. Like maybe this was in use in that year, but like, would it have been in use in this country or people
in this way? I always think of that back and forth in Northanger Abbey when Catherine Morland and Mr. Chilton are fighting over the meaning of the word nice. And the meaning is shifting and he's using it one way and she's using it another. And it's like, and you look at that and you're like, oh my gosh, have I been using nice wrong all these years?
What have I been doing? Well, here's one question that everybody's asking. As you say, you're finding another story. Do you take notes for a different story? Like if you see something, are you putting, I'll use this later in another book. Are you doing that all the time?
All of us are going like bobbleheads when you said that.
No, I will say I don't. I make a mental note, but the second I commit it to paper, I'm already thinking about the next book, which pulls me away from thinking about the current book. So like I tuck it away and maybe I'll like dog ear the page or whatever so that I know if I go looking for it later, I can find it. But like I have to stay with the current book or I get distracted.
I'm always like here, there, and everywhere.
So I've got to tuck it away, copy it, print it out, put it in a notebook, stick it in Scrivener because I will never find it again.
When we started our event tonight, they told us we had to close out our tabs, and I had to close about 50 tabs because I'll find these random fun things. I'm like, I have to use that for the next book, and I'll just leave the tab open on my computer so I won't read it. So 50 tabs. Well, no, now I can go to the little history bar, and as soon as we're done, I'm going to restore all tabs so I have them back.
My son always comes in and goes, how can you have all those windows open? Aren't you confused? I said, no, because then if I can't answer one question, I'll go do the other one. It's not hard. It's not hard. Here's another question. Lauren, this one's for you. On the subject of what women brought to the war zone, you have the character Annie, who was very proud of her lace collars. Did you base her on a real smithy?
Yes, I did. Although I'm not telling who, because I tried, you know, some, I deliberately substituted fake people for my real ones, you know, partly because of these comments in their letters home saying this was private. I intended this for you. Do not share this. This is not public. And so I figured it was kosher to take their innermost thoughts and feelings and attributes as long as I didn't say it was them, because that way I'm not betraying their confidence. But there was one woman who I took a lot of the details for that character from the lace collars and also the little silver flask of sherry she sips from when she gets nervous. Because, you know, most of these women in their letters home from the war zone, they were relentlessly perky. They were like Rilla of Ingleside, if anyone else is an Anne fan. And, you know, they would try to very much make light of all of the dangers they were facing. You know, they didn't make light of the villagers or the troubles they were facing. They were very earnest about that. But if it came to them, it was sort of like, oh, and then we nearly got shot by German soldiers. Ha, ha, ha. What a lark. But there was this one woman who wrote home letters that were not like this, where she was like, I was scared and I took out my flask and I took a few sips of sherry because they were shelling all night. It really scares me. And I was so touched by her comments because she let all these vulnerabilities come through in her letters in the way the others really didn't. And so, yeah, that's my lace collar woman who was trying to find ways to buoy herself up in a situation where she felt really lost and lonely and scared.
But do you think they were also doing that because they didn't want to get yanked home? Like the family say, just come back. Like, oh no, it's all wonderful. Like, buck up. Here's where we are.
The funny thing is, so I did an event a couple of days ago where I was asked, did their families let them do that? And their families had no say. These were all independent women. Yeah. They ranged in age from their mid-20s to their early 50s. And I mean, the bulk of them were roughly around 30. There were a lot of 30th birthday parties in the Psalm that year. And, you know, their families had no right to call them back. And also, oh, they had signed 6-month contracts.
Okay, you know, right. Yeah.
I mean, there were two women who left early. One had a nervous breakdown and one, her mother died. So they got out of their 6-month contracts. But other than that, the 6-month contracts were taken very, very seriously. But these were independent adult women who had made their decision to go, and no one was calling them back if they didn't want to go.
Huh. So at any point when you were doing your research, you say, oh, I would have done this. Would you have done it, Lauren?
No, I would have been the one who was like, oh my gosh, this is so lovely of you guys. I will send a check.
Okay, how about everybody else? Would you have done it or would you have sent the check? I think I'm going to send the check.
Yeah.
Oh, 10 children.
The check.
Yeah. No, good. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, so no, there were like auxiliary things people were doing. There was an office in New York where people were doing back end stuff for the Smith unit. And they complained also that people at home needed, really, really needed to stop knitting things to send to them. Like, please stop knitting things, just send money. Stop going through your grandmother's attic and sending us old clothes. Really, just send us a check. We'll buy stuff. It'll be great. Just, you know, stop. But I could see myself being in the New York office, you know, answering letters for them or sorting through the submission from the Bangor Smith Club when they sent all their grandmother's old clothes, you know, that sort of thing. But I could not imagine doing what these women did and going off into the mud of the Psalm. Mm. Or if I did, I would regret it 5 minutes later and be like, I'm so about breaking that contract. How do I do that again?
You know, can I just write a check now? Yeah, can I write a check in Europe? You know, what can I give you?
The great thing about reading a book like yours, though, is we do get to ask ourselves that question and we get to say, what would I have done? But even if our choice would have been, no, I can't go, we get to choose yes, because we get to read your book and we get to be taken there with them. I mean, that's one of the phenomenal things about this kind of fiction, about historical fiction, is you always get to choose yes and go on that journey, you know, and maybe you grow a little bit in the process. You know?
Well, I was thinking sort of part of the appeal, I think, of World War II fiction right now is that you're looking at characters who didn't voluntarily say yes, and that all of us to ask ourselves, not would I have said yes, but what would happen if my world turned upside down in a moment and I had to make choices when the chips are down? What would I do? And I think that's one of the great appeals of we're trying on these situations for ourselves and seeing if we could rise to the occasion.
Totally right.
And I think that that's the reason your books make for very good discussion books for book groups, because I think that people could go around the table and say, who would I be? What would I do? Yeah. Who would I be of that person in the room? Yeah. Because it's like, would I have gone? Would I have stayed home? And if I was there, could I fix the truck? Like, which one would I have been? What would my skill set have been? And it leads to a much bigger conversation, whether it's World War II or the historic women that we feel are very, very strong, or a woman we knew nothing about. It's okay. What am I bringing? Like, by reading this book, what am I bringing to the conversation? What am I bringing to my own life? Because when I think I've got it tough, who am I thinking about now? When we were all young, we all read Anne Frank. And then we could picture sitting in the attic, being really quiet. I mean, who didn't sit there for the next, hour trying not to make any noise or thinking what was going on? And you think about it, when you read like that, you're automatically brought into those situations. And it's like, who would I be? And sometimes we're not proud of who we say we would be. We're not, but we realize with other people, we're very strong before us. And what are they teaching us as a result? You know?
Exactly.
So. Well, I'm going to wish, first of all, congratulations to all of our winners over in our chat. We're going to have one more trivia question. All the winners, you will be receiving an email from the publisher tomorrow to coordinate shipping. And for those of you, I think we've gone through all the questions. Let me just go see if there's anything I missed. It's kind of hard to read questions while I'm doing. Marie, can you just jump in and say, what was your favorite Agatha Christie book?
Oh my gosh, which one was my favorite? All, I mean, okay, I've right. read so many of them. I would have to say I have a couple categories. Favorite Agatha Christie is probably, let's go with favorite Hercule Poirot is Murder on the Orient Express and Death on the Nile. I mean, they're the classics, but I love them. I love Unreliable Narrator has to be Murder of Roger Ackroyd. I have a sentimental favorite, which is one people probably never read, and that is On the Man in the Brown Suit. It's like a caper from her youth, and she wrote an incredible spy thriller, actually, called N or M, set in World War II. That's the thing about Agatha. It's like, whatever you're looking for, she's got it, and she did it. She's just amazing.
She's got some story about it. So, Lauren, I know you're working on a next project. Can you give us any hint of that before we go to your final question of the night?
Oh, yes. Well, it's actually a sort of prequel to Band of Sisters, because I became really fascinated by the real life founder of the Smith College Relief Unit while I was writing this book. And my fictionalized version of her started dropping little hints about her past, because this woman was in the 1890s. She graduated from Smith with a classics degree and went off to the American School in Athens determined to excavate, and was told young ladies did not do that. And she was asked, would she like to be a classics librarian? She's like, no, I can't. Came here to dig things up, I'm going to dig. But while she was there fighting for her right to excavate, the Greco-Turkish War broke out, and she got swept up into the Greco-Turkish War and was decorated by the Queen of Greece for her bravery nursing. Now, but then there's this weird blip in her life, and this is what catches me, because we're all talking about how we think of our stories and what draws us. For me, it's the gaps. It's the silences where you're like, what are they not telling you? Because a year later she goes back to Greece and she excavates Crete and makes her name, and people are still reading those excavation reports today. But in that intervening year, she randomly goes back to the United States, where she joins Clara Barton's Red Cross and nurses in the Spanish-American War. And there is no earthly reason for her to do this. I couldn't figure out why. It's like, what drove her to do this? But my fictional character started giving me hints. And so this is what that book is about. It's about this young Smithy who finds her life turned upside down in the Greco-Turkish War and sort of redeems herself and finds the woman she's meant to be in the jungles of Cuba. And it's actually thanks to my marvelous librarian friend, Vicky. This was another one of these books where there is a bit of historical information that came my way that everyone's forgotten, but that turned this book around, about the heroic and forgotten nurses of the Spanish-American War and some of the amazing stuff they did. So I am so excited to serve this book.
Oh, it sounds like you make great headway on it.
When I was reading the book, I thought I wanted to know more about her story.
I thought the same thing.
She was just the little bit that we see of her in there, which is not a little bit, but she's not the primary character. I just thought she was so captivating. Yep. I'm so glad you're bringing her to life. That's phenomenal.
Well, and don't you love it when you're writing one book and a character starts talking to you and suddenly you have a whole other story there just waiting to be explored? Because some books are kind of flat. They are just themselves, and others just have this endless life to them. They just sort of sprawl out on you.
That's so true.
I love it.
You know what I am going to do? some people are asking for the answers to the questions. So how about if I go and do the answers to the trivia questions real fast? So who was the first woman to run for president of the United States? Lauren, it was?
Victoria Woodhull.
Marie, question number two. The first woman appointed justice to the Supreme Court was?
Sandra Day O'Connor.
Okay, Vanessa, who's the first person to win two Nobel Prizes for science?
Marie Curie.
Kristen, what female tennis player was a serious advocate for equal pay at Wimbledon and successfully went on to become the first women's champion to get equal prize money?
Venus Williams.
And what woman was the first African-American woman to win the Nobel Prize for Literature? It was Toni Morrison. Marie, back to you. Which Guinness World Record does Agatha Christie hold?
The world's best-selling novelist.
Vanessa, who is NASA's first Black female engineer?
Mary Jackson.
Kristen, what is the name of the allegorical cultural icon of World War II that represented women who worked in factories and shipyards?
Rosie the Riveter.
And what year was, this is my question, what's the first woman of color elected to the House of Representatives? And that was 1965. So Lauren is going to do the last question for the night. So there will be another chance to win. We've been seeing that we're going to review the chat log to make sure that they've got the correct winners. If somebody answered correctly before the winner, we'll make sure that we get the prizes going to both people, because everything is fair in this event tonight, because we're all women and we want to make sure history is recorded correctly. So Lauren, you're on for our next question. And thanks to everyone for joining us. Take it away, Lauren.
Okay. And anyone who has been hanging out on my website or Facebook page recently should be able to get this question, people. You're on your mettle. Okay. Question 10. What iconic feature at Smith College is a tribute to the women of the Smith College Relief Unit who traveled to France during World War II to provide humanitarian aid? Okay, guys, go.
We know there's a subtle delay, so we're looking.
Oh,
but
we
got it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well done.
Very nice.
Well
work.
Done. Well
done. Because you've actually been reading my posts. Thank you. And now it's time, I guess, to say goodbye and good night to everyone. I want to say so many thanks to Carol for moderating us so brilliantly. This time we let you get a word in edgewise. Thank you to Marie and Vanessa and Kristen. Thank you so much for celebrating with me tonight. I can't think of anyone I would rather kick off Women's History Month with. And everyone should rush out and pre-order Island Queen and buy The Mystery of Mrs. Christie and The Book of Lost Names. These are all such fabulous books, and you have such treats in store for you. And thank you to everyone for joining us tonight on a Monday night. I am just so thrilled that you could come and celebrate with us here tonight. You have just completely made my week and my book launch and everything. Thank you, and have a wonderful week. Good night, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue.